Hello and welcome to Mentor Dialogue, episode number 494. My name is Mentor Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on the network, please do go and visit evergreenpodcast.com. So this week's interview is with my friend Anita Novak. Anita is an empathy activist, an expert, principal, and founder of PVM Studio, a global advisory firm that supports purpose-driven individuals, family offices, foundations, and companies. Anita is also the author of Purposeful Empathy, Tapping Our Hidden Superpower for Personal, Organizational, and Social Change, which is due out in April 2023. In this conversation with Anita, we discuss her journey to becoming an empathy enthusiast, the power of the empathic embrace, new research on and the future of empathogens such as MDMA, misconceptions about empathy, as well as some of the useful tools in her book around self-development, virtues, and questions for reflection. You'll find all the show notes on MentorDial.com. And please, if you have a single moment, do go and drop in a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Anita Novak, how lovely to have you on my show at bloody last, I should say. You were kind enough to have me on your show. You and I have been empathy activists, working with all sorts of wonderful people. I feel like we know so many people in common, although we've never met, and I've never really met so many of them. So you lived in Tbilisi, you're now back in Montreal. In your own words, Anita, who is Anita, Dr. Anita Novak?
Well, Mentor, so lovely to see you again. It's been a while, and you're right. We do have a great circle of empathy enthusiasts. And, you know, we both do podcasts about meaningful conversations and empathy, and you don't typically meet a bunch of assholes that work in that space. So we're both meaningful.
Amen. Amen.
Who am I? I think I would describe myself as a lifelong learner slash educator. I've studied for a long, long time. Neither of my parents went to, they didn't pursue higher education. They were both born in Europe during the war, came over to Canada as immigrants, met. And I didn't grow up with a conversation of consequence at the dinner table, to be honest. And that I don't hold that against my parents, but they didn't pursue formal education. So beyond their high school. And I did, which made them proud. And then I did a graduate diploma and a master's degree and a PhD. And my dad was like, are you done yet? And I'm like, no. So I went and did a coaching degree, and I'm thinking going back to school now. So I love learning. I love unlearning too. That's something I share with my undergraduates, because I teach three different courses at McGill. I teach leadership, I teach ethics and management, and I teach social entrepreneurship and innovation. And I share with my students that so much of their job while they're doing their undergrads is to really unlearn some of the social stories and the stories that have been projected onto them by, you know, their parental units or society, and just really kind of question things. Really, that's the time, right? They're in their late teens, early 20s, to really question things. So I'm a learner and an unlearner, and a teacher. That's who I am.
Beautiful. Well, and an eternal learning. I think that's sort of what we all ought to be. And your course on ethics and management, I was talking to the chairman of several companies on the board, and I was like, so just a question. I was wondering, to what extent ethics is a conversation in the boardroom? Or what do you mean? Well, I don't mean much more than that. I just wonder to what extent explicitly you talk about being ethical. Well, we talk about charities and ESG and How do you find the conversation about ethics in management happening?
Well, the way I've designed the class is the front end of the class is we look at ethics from three different perspectives, from a psychological perspective, where we, you know, explore whistleblowing, for example. So what is the psychology of someone who's willing to stand by and watch an unethical thing kind of take place, or someone who can't tolerate that, right? And we have good examples of whistleblowers all over the place, and they do important work. Then we look at ethics from a philosophical lens, right? So, you know, what the principles upon which ethics and ethical decisions are made. And then we look at it from values. And I think that's the big one for students, is that we're not used to talking explicitly about our values. And we think we know what our values are, but actually when we do a little investigation, there's a great assignment where we have 100 words like that are values. And I ask them to sort of choose the 10 values that they most align with, not from like, I wish I were this way, but like, I really am this way. These are my core values. And then we go down to 5. And then the real work is go down to 2. Choose your 2 top values. And sometimes, you know, you're choosing between honesty and integrity or compassion and respect. So it's tough. And I think that's where the real meat on the bones are. When you're talking about ethics and making ethical decisions, they have to be made based on what you value. And so that's the beginning of the course. The second part of the course is we do some cases. I have lots of guest speakers coming in to talk about different experiences they've had, whether they work in philanthropy. I have one senior leader in communications that was actually the senior vice president of SNC-Lavalin, a major engineering firm, has, you know, 50,000 employees around the world. And they were kind of having contracts with Gaddafi. And they got caught, you know, doing some very unethical things, and she, how she managed that. So we have a lot of cases, and then the students do some research of their own and teach the class. So I've got some students looking at the prison industrial complex, some students looking at fast fashion and the ethical issues around that. So it's a great course to teach. A lot of fun.
Well, certainly. And the work you do on values, I want to get into that a little later, hopefully with your framework, but what it strikes me, and maybe it's a core concept that also will have an effect on empathy, is that somehow, well, I believe that ethics are deeply personal. Mm-hmm. And so are your values. And we kind of get this idea that there are corporate values, but corporate values can only be lived and breathed by individuals who are making them come alive. And so it feels like if ethics, this particular chairman said, well, ethics, really, we don't want to talk about it. We only talk about it when we get caught. Mm-hmm. And then, then we'll sort of ask for pardon afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like that's sort of a Wall Street-y or, you know, the streets approach is, you know, give me growth, give me shareholder return. I don't really care how. Mm-hmm. So it feels like we need to talk to those people about ethics. We go in there all gung-ho, naive to some degree, and anyway, hopeful. But there's a whole system that needs to be undone before we can really bring ethics into business.
I agree. I think the cultural norms of organizations have to permeate the organization. They have to be embodied by all the different stakeholders within the organization. And they certainly need to be valued by the leadership. And there need to be you know, benefits attached to people living up to those core values. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, the leaders at the top don't have to have all the brain power to figure out how that's going to manifest across the organization. So, for example, I was hired by a med school to help them bring more empathy into their culture. And they wanted me to work on the curriculum that their students, so their soon-to-be doctors, are going to go through to become more empathic doctors, right? We need empathic doctors and empathic health workers, obviously. And I was meeting with them, and I really appreciated the holistic attitude or perspective that they had about graduating doctors that care about wellness. So they attach their entire curriculum and their entire med school to the UN SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, that it's about like the wellness for the world, right? And they are actors for wellness. I really love that. And I said to them, why so downstream? Why are you bringing in empathy only in the curriculum for the students? Why not have it come through across the entire organization? So they said, okay, well, what do you have in mind? So we put together a curriculum for their, let's say, 25 leaders and administrators with the school. And we did a couple of sessions together, including how do we create a culture of empathy in the organization? So typical kind of design thinking, brainstorming. And there were six mini groups that broke out into like, you know, little work groups. And three out of the six, so half of the people in the room had the same recommendation about how the organization could be could live a more empathic culture. And one of the suggestions they made is they don't have a place in their building where they can come and hang out together, just sort of like a staff lounge, right? They go to meetings, they see each other, they maybe walk down the hall and they meet each other, but they don't actually can relax together. And the leadership really listened to that. So between that session and the next session, which is basically like a weekend in between, they emptied a huge storeroom with the photocopier and the boxes. They painted it, bought some couches, bought some yoga mats, put a, you know, large screen TV, and did a big reveal. And look, I got goosebumps when I'm talking about it. I've mentioned this story so often. People were crying. These leaders were walking into this room and felt heard. So I think so many of the cultural values that organizations have can be embodied by all the frontline workers. Everybody across the organization can contribute to what it means to be that kind of organization, and doesn't need a big top-heavy strategic plan to do it.
It strikes me, Anita, in listening to you, it needs you to be a little bit crazy all the same, because everything is so transactional at work. You know, this is the meeting room to do this. This is what we're doing at this meeting, and how much are you getting for that? And it's ROI focused, KPI focused. A meeting room where we just meet and shoot the shit. You know, we don't need that. We got to be busy. And so the crazy part is, well, listening to people have this crazy idea and then actually implementing it. I feel like anybody who's listening to this, who doesn't have a crazy room or a crazy person who can lead to the room, that's the first thing you need to be, every company should be doing, every business should be doing, allowing for meeting at a personal, informal, casual level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's the way we build social capital, and that's where we feel a sense of belonging. So that, what, you know, I've got a lot of people, if I, you know, do a little workshop or a seminar on empathy and empathic cultures, they'll say, well, we're a high performance culture, so that's going to kind of get in the way. And my response is, no, actually, the metrics bear out totally differently, where if you have space where people can collide naturally and just ask about the weekend and ask about, hey, how was the wedding you went to, or how's the your son's graduation? How did that go? People can naturally build up friendships, and then trust goes up. And then when you have miscommunications, you don't assume the worst of each other, you assume the best because you know each other, they're just having a bad day. All sorts of positive things start to happen that allows for greater creativity and innovation, less turnover. So there's just, it's so old-fashioned to think that creating spaces where people can be human before their role and responsibility as employees. So it's so old fashioned to think that that gets in the way of the work. That actually greases the wheel for the work to go more smoothly.
I love the word used, collide. And your book has so many great examples and lots of useful things to do in a company. But I wanted to pick out one sentence that, let's say, raised my eyebrow, but mostly because I smiled heavily. And said, to our brains, an empathic embrace, I think of collide, is as rewarding as great sex and psychedelic drugs. You're talking to business people? How does that work?
Well, it's true. The neuroscientists have studied that. Okay, so here's what I've learned, is that when you have your brain in one of those fMRI machines, they can sense what's lit up in your brain. And what they've discovered is being in an empathic embrace, so feeling a sense of kinship and belonging and connection with someone, the pleasure and reward centers of your brain light up. The same pleasure and reward centers that light up when you eat good food, when you are in a high state of meditative kind of like energy, when you're high on psychedelics, and when you're experiencing post-coital bliss. And that one, I always wonder, like, how do the researchers know that one?
But... Exactly. Yeah. I mean, how do you, they just qualify it was good. It was good sex.
It was good.
But I mean, you also mentioned, and for me, this leads into another thought, but you also talk about how Metzner, the Harvard researcher, talks how the presence of MDA triggers the release of prolactin, which is the same hormone when you breastfeed or for mother-infant bonding. So as far as MDMA is concerned, I mean, it feels like the empathic embrace is a proxy for the MDMA, which is doing the same thing as making you feel like you're feeding your child with your breastfed, you know, with breast milk. Which is so reassuring and fulfilling at some level. I
mean, Mother Nature is so amazing, right? So if Mother Nature produces these hormones to connect the infant to the mother, that's for this, that's to instill a sense of the mother wants to take care of the child. She feels good in taking care of the baby, and the baby is latching on to the mother. And that's for both of them to thrive so that the baby will grow up feeling safe and secure and will, you know, at least grow to a time when the child can be more independent. Now, imagine if that those same hormones could be released in another circumstance where closeness and attachment and bonding is core to it. You know, you probably, if you read the chapter where I talk about the neuroscience of empathy and I talk about the kind of interesting new research that's coming out about psychedelics, you'll know that ecstasy was first called empathy before somebody in LA said, actually, I think we're going to sell more drugs if we sell, if we call it ecstasy. But the drug itself is the most, widespread experience that people talk about is this closeness and connection and empathy they feel towards people when they're high on that drug. So I find it fascinating that there's this resurgence of research around psychedelics for therapeutic purposes, to help people with PTSD, fighting addictions, fighting all sorts of trauma. But I also want, exactly. And I think, imagine if we weren't attached to all our pharmacological solutions. Imagine, and I don't mean to abuse of it and let it just be about raves and parties. Imagine with guided therapy, you could feel a state of wholeness and connection with people that would be healing beyond years and years and years of talk therapy. I think there's great opportunity and great potential there.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
Well, I did have a friend of mine who launched a ketamine, a psychedelic short-lasting assisted therapy center in New York. And I plan to have more because I fundamentally, personally have and fundamentally believe in the power of psychedelics to raise consciousness, to rewire the brain, to make you feel as insignificant as you truly are, to get rid of the ego. And all of these things, actually, if you translate them into business, Well, we should also have having sex and take drugs at work. Makes me think. But I mean, certainly my MDMA, usually done in a fun, spirited way, to get to know that feeling and to get to feel that that sense of kinship and bonding, you know, in a platonic manner even, is so powerful. And the challenge, of course, is keeping it in business. So the issue is, how does one transition non-empathic CEOs, an unempathic culture, into being more, I would say, cultivated, but at least more empathic?
That's a really big question. I think part of it will come when people realize how much they benefit. So one of the things that I discovered is, okay, we know Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Think of your intro to psych class. And once your basic
psych 101.
Exactly.
By the way, hey, Anita, I'm going to tell this is first time public recording. My psych 101 exam at Colgate University, I took two tabs of LSD 2 hours before the exam started. I didn't know the exam was coming. So I actually wrote my psych 101 high on LSD, close parentheses.
How'd you do?
I got a 98 out of 100. I was enlightened.
That's amazing. That's a great story, entre parenthèses. I don't even remember what we were talking about. What were we talking about?
We were talking about making businesses get with the program, benefits. If they understand the benefits, they will get there.
Yeah. And what was I going to say about this? I had something that I was going to say. So hold
on. I'm sorry for the interruption. That's
oh, no,
crazy,
I loved it.
That's the crazy way I work. But, I mean, basically, we know that empathy can help creativity. It can help engagement. It can help client centricity, customer service. But the challenge is making them sort of understand it and then making it happen, because empathy, in the end of the day, for me, takes time.
Right. Okay. So thank you for that segue back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So that little triangle that you remember from your intro to psych class was actually never his. Somebody who was doing the textbook decided to put it into a triangle. It's a little footnote of history that I learned. We all know the triangle. So your baseline needs are met, right? Food and shelter, and then a sense of belonging and friendship, and then intimacy, and then all the way up to self-actualization. So the idea that Maslow had was, you know, we're trying to, as we fulfill our other needs, we're trying to self-actualize. That's the highest state that humans can achieve, is a sense of fulfilling their potential. And we believe that, right? That's a very compelling story. And it's existed for many years, and it's part of the positive psychology movement that I think he can take credit for being sort of like the grandfather of. What we are learning more recently is that towards the end of his life, in unpublished work that's surfacing, he actually realized how wrong his model was, that self-actualization is not the pinnacle of what we can achieve in our human endeavors. Actually, it's self-transcendence. And self-transcendence happens once we've self-actualized. How can we put our gifts to service, right? To serve others and be of help. Let our lives be purposeful to help other people. And I think the great thing about being of service is that it actually really feeds our souls. So right now, I think we're in the perfect society for our souls to decay. It's all of it is about buy this so you fill the hole. Look like this, so you can fill the hole. You know, there's this whole social media amplifies it and makes it worse. And just everything about our consumer culture is like, you are not enough. You are unworthy. And, you know, you have to be more of your, be more, do more, work harder, buy more. And the reality is, if we give more, if we appreciate more, if we're more grateful for all the gifts that we have, and we recognize that we are all born with the capacity to generate incredible things. We are all generative by nature. That's who we are as human beings. If we could tap into all of that, then empathy would come so easy and we would all benefit. There's just so much benefit. I mean, just in my one little anecdote that I like to share, when I was learning about the neuroscience of empathy and that we could become more empathic with practice, right? Thanks to neuroplasticity. And now the work of Jamil Zaki is like, even believing that it's possible to become more empathic actually changes the outcome of how much empathy we show. When I started learning about all that like 10 years ago, I remember this one instance. I was doing all sorts of experiments, but this one day I was in a lineup at a FedEx office, and it was busy holiday season, December, and it was before mobile phones were in our hands as like the appendage to our hand, scrolling through just to keep us busy and occupied, right? So I was in a lineup for about half an hour, got to the counter, and the woman who greeted me was rude. And I mean, like, really unnecessarily rude. And I immediately was like, what is wrong with you? You know, and I, you know, you get triggered. Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, okay, I don't want to speak to you. Give me your manager. Like, you are so super unacceptable to me. But in that moment, I said, okay, I'm going to practice something that I'm learning. I'm going to see whether I can extend empathy when I'm feeling least empathic for this gal. And I paused and I looked at her and I said, are you okay? And there was this little pregnant pause when she was trying to discern whether I was being sarcastic or not. And she realized I was being earnest and she burst into tears. And she said, I have been working double shifts for 2 weeks. My son's at home with a fever and I'm getting sick. It's 3 p.m. I haven't had a lunch break. I am flat out exhausted. And that little question, which revealed what her circumstances were, allowed me to see her as a human being where I've been there. I could relate to her. I all of a sudden had tons of empathy for her. I remember getting her a mint tea from the food court. We had an amazing connection that has stayed with me all these years later, where empathy opened up for our common humanity to show up in a totally like natural, organic way. She then said a few things, got a few things off her chest. She proceeded to send my package off with grace and efficiency. And I had practiced empathy. I had made the decision consciously and purposefully to practice empathy. And as a result of that experience, I tried over and over in all sorts of different circumstances when it was not natural for me to do it because I was triggered to actually say, okay, let me see if I can dial up the empathy. And I have done it over and over. I'm not certainly not a perfect person. I still am very unempathic many times. But I am a happier person, I think, as a result of practicing empathy. And I think if more people understood how much of a gift it is to be an empathic person, we would be more empathic as a culture.
Amen to that. And you know, this other point of you're not empathic. It's impossible to be empathic all the time with everybody, all the, you know, everywhere. And so we need to get off that perfect pitch. And know that there's time, because the issue I see in business is that it actually takes effort, it takes presence of mind, it takes being present, so that rather than being triggered as you could have been by this nasty FedEx greeting, you just tapped in. Are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to listen. Because if the person says, yeah, my son is dying and I'm this and that and I'm hard, you know, and you're like, yeah, but I want my package gone. Transaction. Business, you might get the package to go, but you didn't create anything and didn't help anything. And that was a lasting wound in that relationship. So if you think in business, how transactional people are, how you doing? Good, good, good. Oh, good, good, good. You know, don't even tell me anything bad. Mm-hmm. And I feel like while there was some of that going on in the pandemic, because people realized that people weren't all good and people were at home and such, and the cat comes on and the child is crying. But as we've come out of it, I feel like it's very quickly going to come back to, especially since the pressures on economics and business are going to be here, that we will just quickly revamp back if we can't lean into it. So with time being short, your title of your book is Purposeful Empathy. And I wanted to see if you could tie in for me purpose and time to be empathic, as opposed to just purposeful empathy. In other words, what's the link between purpose and being able to be empathic?
Mm-hmm. I think it's fantastic that humans have the capacity to empathize. We evolved as a species and survived and thrived as a species because of our capacity to empathize. That's just not my opinion. That's people who've studied evolutionary science have come to that conclusion. And when you were talking about the corporate situation where it's all transactional and we might kind of revert back to the old ways of being, you know, when the pressure's on and recession is coming and all that stuff, I believe that leaders, the two really core competencies that they need to develop is the capacity to listen and the capacity for self-awareness. Because it's not enough that somebody comes into your office and, you know, you're half present for them. You've just read an email where you haven't met your KPIs and you're feeling triggered yourself. And then an employee comes in and they want to take, you know, time off because they had a miscarriage or whatever's going on in their lives, right? You need to, first of all, if you're personally triggered, like I was in that circumstance, right? At the FedEx, like she upset me and I made the decision to switch gears, where I was self-aware to say, oh, I could react in a way that feels much more natural in the moment to do. It's what I feel would be juicy to say, what's wrong with you? Like, don't treat me like this. But I actually took the nanosecond to say, no, I'm actually going to practice being empathic on purpose. And that is something that you can develop. Like you go to the gym and you work out your biceps with curls, you can become more empathic with practice. And that is choosing to be empathic on purpose. It's great that we can become, that we have capacity to empathize, but what do we do with it? We choose to be empathic on purpose. So by just asking the question, how are you, elicited for her a space where I actually cared. And then I stayed with it to listen with an open heart. And then the empathy just kind of, you know, blossomed all by itself. And I think that that's a really important skill and competency for leaders to develop, is the capacity to, okay, how am I feeling right now? Okay, I'm choosing to switch gears because the need of the person in front of me is right there and I need to be present to listen. We spend most of our time, we think we're listeners and that's a joke. We spend most of our time listening to respond instead of listening to understand. It's certainly amplified whenever we're feeling any emotional charge, and we're living, swimming in emotional charge on toxic social media where everybody's in these echo chambers and we hate each other. The minute we hear like a word that is associated to a particular political orientation, we're all of a sudden dismissive, and we have got to keep our own emotions in check to be able to hear what someone else is saying without immediately having this, like, you know, response. Yeah, that's what I would say about that.
Well, I feel like there's this sort of a number of things that have got together that have created this situation. As you were talking about a little bit before, I can't help but think that the fact that we only have one or two children generally has contributed to this. It used to be like you were part of a football team, and you were, or the family was a community. Now it's like, and you didn't even know if how many you had and the names of everybody kind of thing. Where now it's just one or two, maybe three occasionally, but on balance, and everyone's a prince and the perfect, and you better protect them. And we have time for everything. They're the most important people. So we've created a situation as parents where they expect everything to be about them. And it stays with them throughout. And so this lack of community, and then you have this whole session of fear and the social media missing out, or I got to show a perfect Instagram. And this idea of listening without an agenda, or, and certainly without a judgment. It's like you're that silly room you have. You know, I don't have time for that. It's not giving me direct results. And yet there seems to be so many studies that show it will bring results. And I feel like there's this, on the other hand, there's HR issues of too much information. That's private. You can't talk to me about my night out last night, or my relationships with somebody, because gender differences, sexuality differences. So there's a data issue, there's a privacy issue. And so sometimes in work, we constrain ourselves so much that we can't really, I can't hug you because, oh, that might be me too. If me, man, with you, woman, in a business environment. And so we've kind of I know what the word is, sanitized. That's my French, sanitized. We've made it so clean and so legal that this notion of messy humanity at work doesn't have a place.
Well, okay, so let's go back to the earlier point that you made about families. We certainly have, I think, secluded ourselves as family units without the intergenerational and the sort of, you know, it takes a village to raise children. We're all living in single dwelling homes and each kid has their own bedroom. And I think that that's contributed to a sense of sort of like more alienation and more personal boundaries as opposed to community. So I think that that is true. There's research out of Harvard that, you know, parents, when you ask them, what do you want for your kid? You want your kid to be healthy and happy, right? But
and a lot will say wealthy too.
And maybe, yeah, maybe too.
Unfortunately.
So successful, I guess. But most parents put so much pressure on the academics as opposed to developing the SEL, the social emotional learning of the child, right? And one of the things that I learned, which I found fascinating. So for my own PhD, I interviewed social entrepreneurs. These are career change makers that use the entrepreneurial skills of any entrepreneur, but then applies it to a social or environmental problem, right? And I wanted to understand, why did they choose to spend their life working on a complex social issue like homelessness or poverty or racism, right? And it's a Sisyphus, right? You're probably never going to solve the problem, but you're working on it and you're trying to find levers, right? To create some positive social impact in the world. And there were two things across the board that I heard over and over when I interviewed these social entrepreneurs. And I was agnostic to what issue they were working on, but I was asking them questions about their lives. One thing that they all had in common was that they had service behavior modeled at home in their families. So the idea of families doing volunteer work together was part of their childhood. They all had memories of that. And I don't think it's, you know, we're busy taking our children to hockey practice and to violin lessons or whatever. And they're like over stimulated and over, you know, their agendas are full. They're driving around all over the place to make sure that their CV is good to get into the filler school that becomes the filler school that ultimately like takes you up the cheminement to Harvard or Stanford. And I don't believe that there's enough exposure to service again, which is, you know, already at the highest scale of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, just to realize how much
self-transcendence
we benefit by being of service. So that's one thing when it comes to raising children that I would say that I found super fascinating to learn about. The other that I learned about was that they all felt compelled to act on empathy for others. So that was the second thing. But where you took it after we talked about the children was in the office, or where, remind me what you led with?
Well, essentially the notion of empathy being you have to have the time for it, you have to have the mindset, the presence to do it. And I'm so busy doing other things with my goals, the pressure, it inevitably falls off the wagon because don't have time for it.
Yeah, that's why for a lot of people the pandemic was one of those moments of reflection about our life and to slow down and to spend more time with our family. And I inevitably, especially if the recession gets worse, and I think there's going to be a course correction in the markets, and we're seeing already the tragic outcomes of climate change that's only going to worsen over time. You know, oil prices are going to go up. There's going to be so many economic demands, and then political instability, you know, all over the place, the rise of totalitarian kind of, you know, tough men taking over power.
In democracies,
that we're in for some hard times ahead. And I think we're going to find solace in community and in our relationships. And that has always been with us as human beings, but we forget about that. But that's the place where we're going to find some support systems, is in our natural communities, in our natural caring communities. And it's a shame that we forget about that when we're in a better financial circumstance, that all of a sudden having more and wanting more is the ethos of fulfillment, which it isn't. Why are we seeing such a rise in mental health and addiction and self-harm and suicide? Why is that all on the rise? Because we're not feeling connected and feeling a sense of purpose and meaning in our lives.
I would add that some people will have attached themselves to certain causes like global warming, but they're so big, so Sisyphean, to use your term, that I'm never going to be able to do anything. So I think that the idea of community and going more local and being sort of less ambitious somehow, to be more realistic, is going to help you accomplish something for others, being in the service of others. And community is a part of that, you know, whether it's, you know, your family, extended or local community, plus, you know, in counterpoint or in paradox of the globalization idea, where we're all one planet. I think that the luster is off, that we're all one human race. There's no doubt that, for me, there's always been no doubt that that's not true. We have to belong to a community, which means that we do not belong to every community. Mm. Otherwise, you belong to everybody, you belong to nobody. Mm. Nita, I wanted to talk to you about the self-development tool you discovered. You have so many things in your book. Can't do it. Great book. Really loved it. I want anyone who's listening to this to go and find Purposeful Empathy, Tapping Our Hidden Superpower for Personal, Organizational, and Social Change by Broadleaf Books. What other links can people have? Find out about what you're up to, because you are really one of those wonderful empathy enthusiasts, activists that people need to listen to.
Well, just the YouTube channel. Every week I put out a podcast and a YouTube video with other empathy enthusiasts. I've interviewed a woman by the name of Amanda Lutterman that you know, who has the Center for Erotic Empathy. I've interviewed people who are looking at how to develop empathy in young kids, neuroscientists that are studying not only mirror neurons, but the fact that there are social neurons, that even in a space, we are, resonating off each other's kind of vibrational fields. So I'm just interested in amplifying the voices of people who understand that the world needs more empathy and are doing something about it. So that would be the place that I would send anyone who's listening and is curious how to leverage empathy at a higher frequency.
So I thank you for your work, Anita. I certainly thank you for also including me in your book. I really appreciate that. And get the book, go find your usual bookstores and download, buy Purposeful Empathy. Read it, digest it, and do it. Anita, merci beaucoup.
Avec plaisir, Minter.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. If you like the show, would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MinterDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 and more blog posts on MinterDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote. Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust is a reason. Still, I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hope for your respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die submerged. A convinced man in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, come
competition's innate.
I'm a convinced man
in the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man. In these confines, a convinced man in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready for an arrest.
I'm a convinced man in the arms of a woman.
Best known investor and Wall Street expert Warren Buffett once said, "Wall Street is the only place that people ride to in a Rolls Royce to get advice from those who take the subway." Mr. Buffett's quote is remarkably accurate, but how many people would rather receive advice from him than someone simply guessing? Welcome to Buy, Hold, Sell, your single source for Wall Street knowledge and profitable guidance. Please join me, Todd Schoenberger, and fellow trader Tobin Smith, as well as host Veronica Dudo, for a podcast known to move the needle for investors. Tobin and I are seasoned Wall Street executives with deep investment experience, and we are prepared to share our advice to those who choose to listen. Download Buy, Hold, Sell today on the Evergreen Podcast Network or your favorite podcast channel.